Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. It's graduation time again across the country, with colleges and universities holding their commencement exercises, including Boston University earlier today. In honor of all the hard work leading up to this important milestone in a young person's life, we thought we'd share with you some of that work, specifically stories written and produced by students from this semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication here at Boston University. The students were given the following assignment: produce a story exploring the theme of innovation. As you might expect, the topics varied widely. We begin with this report from Angus Dunk, looking at an innovative new car being developed at MIT.
How do you commute each day? On the screeching subway? By bus? How about by boat? But do you ever hear this on your commute? That's the sound of MIT's city car. It's like most electric cars in that it reduces pollution and increases energy efficiency. The car is tiny, about the size of a booth at a restaurant, and looks a little like a space-age VW bug. But one of the coolest things about the car is that it can change its shape and fold up. You can tuck its rear end under the front seats to fit neatly into any parking space. Nicholas Pennycook is a researcher on the MIT city car team.
If you can fold this car up so that its length becomes the width of a traditional car, you can fit three of these in one traditional parking spot on road, because now you're getting in and out of the front of the car and you don't need side doors.
Not only can the car change its shape, it also can spin on its axis, so you never need to make a three-point turn. City car designers hope it will be used like the current zip cars, where you lease a car for short trips rather than individual ownership.
So you have more vehicles in less space serving a larger population. And because these vehicles are always moving, land utilization is also good. Instead of having one car parked in a parking spot for 7 hours of the day and not being utilized.
The car's design is space age. It's driven by 8 separate motors, 2 inside each wheel. And the steering wheel resembles a plane's flight yoke. But with a car this tiny, safety is a big concern. The MIT city car team hasn't done any crash testing yet, but plans to later this year. City car team researcher Praveen Subramani predicts it will be as safe as any of the current smart cars already on the road.
You know, if you were in a smart car competing with other large vehicles, of course it's not going to be inherently as safe as driving an SUV around the city, but at low speeds, it will be required to meet all the existing safety standards of a vehicle like that.
This could be good or bad news for drivers. Some of these microcars get mixed safety reviews from the insurance industry and the federal government. In addition to safety, Pennycook says the research team at MIT is assessing the car's long-term need for maintenance. The motors housed in each wheel are modules that can be easily replaced.
Point of failure is more than likely going to be one of the wheel units, but whereas in a traditional car, you can't just transplant the whole motor. It's just not a very feasible idea. But with this, because it's just a module, you can plug out that module and plug in a new one. So the vehicle is back on the road, but the faulty module is gone.
One drawback of the car is that it can only travel 65 miles under a full electrical charge. And unlike hybrid cars, there is no backup gas tank. Chris Pritchard, a MIT graduate student and chemical engineering major, is optimistic about the car itself.
You know, when you look at the lifetime of some of the old cars that were built, old Chevys, old German cars, they last forever. It's definitely possible that these will also last a long time. And actually, a good thing about that would be that, you know, would provide incentive for municipal authorities or city authorities to actually invest in this as a public good, really.
The city car's manufacturer, Hirico Driving Mobility, is building 20 new cars. They will be released next year for testing throughout Europe. Eventually, Hirico intends to distribute the cars in a few cities in this country as rentals for about $7 to $12.
Student reporter Angus Dunk. This is Boston University's World of Ideas, and tonight we're featuring stories written and produced by the students from this semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. I'm Steve Brown. Next up, Annie Ropeek takes a look at innovations in online education.
When you hear the phrase online learning, you might think of for-profit schools like the University of Phoenix, schools that started out virtual. But traditional schools with quads, dorms, and dining halls are putting their degrees online, too. And even here in Boston, many universities are moving into the virtual classroom. Harvard offers partially online undergrad and master's degrees, MIT launched its inaugural online course this spring, and Boston University has more than 10 fully online master's programs, including one without an on-campus equivalent. BU promises that online students will receive as rigorous an education as their on-campus counterparts, from the same faculty, with the same respectable degree at the end. And while it's all tailored for online delivery, Nancy Coleman, the director of distance learning at BU, says the virtual experience is designed to feel as much like the real classroom as possible.
One of the great myths of online education is that you have this lone person sitting at their dining room table at 2 o'clock in the morning doing their coursework. And what we've found is online students really develop a sense of community in among themselves.
One teacher who offers online instruction is BU finance professor V. Bodie. He's the co-author of a popular investments textbook with a significant virtual component. He says he's found internet instruction to be a natural transition in education.
My view is that we already are at a stage where there are huge benefits to, let's call it the virtual classroom, that we can access using readily accessible technology. I mean, what do you need beyond Skype, let's say, on the internet? Not much.
Students in BU's online degree programs work with multimedia lectures and discussion boards online. Professors hold office hours with email, and the classes also include live group audio or video conferences to help cement the material.
I think the live sessions are really, really essential to have something that's, you just sort of completely throw them to the modules and not give them the opportunity to discuss things or to ask questions is not really optimal.
Wayne Lamort teaches epidemiology at BU's School of Public Health. He teaches in traditional classrooms and for the exclusively online Master of Science in Health Communication.
There has to be some real-time interaction between the instructor and the student. Otherwise, you know, if it's all just what they can read on a web page, somehow there's something missing there.
Those live interactions might dispel that image of the lonely learner on her laptop at the dining room table. But some, like Zvi Bodie, worry that universities could be putting themselves out of business in the move online, making the traditional classroom irrelevant.
For many institutions, this may be a disruptive technology, in which case I say, okay, time to change our institutions. I mean, the objective is to spread knowledge. It's not to preserve a particular institution. As much as I personally may love Boston University, unless it adapts, it too will disappear.
For most students today, online classes augment more traditional ones. Again, BU Distance Learning Director Nancy Coleman.
I've always looked at online delivery as not a replacement or something better than something else. It's just another way of delivering the content.
And for now, that's the primary goal of many instructors. Epidemiology professor Wayne Lamort says no matter where students go for their education, they're best served by a mix of approaches. Online learning, he says, lets him get more out of whatever FaceTime he gets with his students.
There are a lot of different activities that one can think of both outside the class and inside the class that involve the student much more in the learning process, put the student at the center of the process rather than at the periphery.
Of course, for most students, college offers more than just classroom instruction. There's plenty of experience, like social functions, to be gained outside the classroom, too. BU officials say that's why the school does not yet offer a fully online undergraduate degree. But graduate students, who make up nearly half of BU's population, have less need for campus life. Jamie Rauscher is a mid-career marketing professional who graduated from BU's online health communication master's program a year ago. She says she was looking for interaction with her fellow students.
The interaction can tend to be a lot richer because people are thinking, you know, they're reading what you wrote, they're digesting it, they're processing it, and they're responding. As opposed to in a bricks and mortar class, someone raises their hand, makes a point, you know, there's not really as much engagement.
Tuition for a full on-campus course load at BU's Metropolitan College is $21,200 per semester. That's the school that also offers online degrees. The same course load for an online degree only costs around $9,000. And that demonstrates what proponents see as the greatest attribute of online learning. Lower costs mean higher education could be available to even more people.
That story filed by student reporter Annie Ropey. Up next, Tim McCann reports on how business and academic leaders are trying to keep fewer students from leaving Massachusetts once they graduate.
What are you planning on doing after graduation?
Right now I'm planning on going home to Oregon.
I'm going to be moving home starting in June, go live with my parents again for a while, save some money.
And where's home for you?
Albuquerque, New Mexico.
These answers from students demonstrate a continuing issue here in Boston. While the area attracts well over a quarter of a million students to its colleges and universities every year, studies suggest only about half of them remain in the area after graduation. Boston is often rated as one of the most livable cities in the country, but concerns about the job market, combined with rising student loan debts, contribute to this brain drain. So what is being done to try and keep graduates here? Boston University junior Maurice Rami has a few suggestions.
So the first level is at the campus level, which includes bringing events to campuses, kind of bringing awareness to campuses, and kind of getting students, you know, educated on what is possible in the city. So once you go to campuses, it's important to mobilize students to go out of their campus bubble and kind of experience what's going on around them. The city has to figure out a way to provide incentive for students, so maybe that means providing subsidized housing.
Making sure students are able to appreciate Greater Boston beyond the college campuses is the goal of the state's Secretary of Housing and Economic Development, Greg Bialecki.
There's too many of our young people who are spending 4 years here, and we have failed to tell them more about all the exciting things that are happening outside of their campuses and outside of their communities, and internships are one way to make that connection.
The high cost of housing is also a concern for state economic development officials.
It was exciting. I attended a groundbreaking at Assembly Square in Somerville, more than 450 new apartment units being built there. Construction's just begun there. It'll be ready next year. And in particular, interesting that the developers of the apartments were really focused on the young post-student marketplace. They had altered the design of the whole project to be most attractive to a, you know, 22 to 29-year-old demographic. And so we're seeing the demand is certainly there for young people, and it's good to see that the real estate development community is responding to that.
When it comes to combating the brain drain here in Boston, both the public and private sectors agree that creating internships is an extremely important and effective tool. One such program is Startup Summer. Northeastern University sophomore Corey Belotsky started the program to connect students with Boston-area startup companies in need of full-time interns during the summer break. Belotsky says the program received about 1,000 applications this year for about 100 positions. Startup Summer also plans to provide networking opportunities for its participants.
So this summer we're planning on running dozens of events, large scale, small scale, for all the students participating, so that they're not only working, but they're also building this network and these mentors.
Belotsky believes that job security is the number one reason that graduates leave the area. He is acutely aware of the brain drain and hopes that Startup Summer can help mitigate it.
We need to do a really good job of exposing those students to what's available here, or they will leave within 12 months of graduation. So I really feel strongly that work experiences are incredibly important, and the more that can be done in both the public and the private sector to give students those experiences while in school, the better that we'll have a chance of getting more students to stay in Massachusetts.
Ultimately, there's only so much that can be done. There's still a sizable amount of uncertainty in the job market for graduates, and given that the average graduate leaves school with about $25,000 in debt, prudence and financial security often win out.
Would you consider coming back here at any point? Do you see yourself coming back?
I could in the future see myself coming back because there are a tremendous amount of opportunities, but at this time I just think for entry-level positions, there are other cities that have more to offer.
Maybe when I retired or something, I might come back to the Boston area for, like, you know, have a house on the Cape or something, you know. Maybe.
Yeah, I would come back here.
Student reporter Tim McCann. This is WBUR. I'm Steve Brown. You're listening to a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Narrative Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Tonight's theme is innovation. Next, student reporter Nisa Lossing introduces us to a new, different kind of tour company.
Clown Shoes. You should definitely know about Clown Shoes. Clown Shoes, I think, are one of the funniest kind of companies that I ever point out. If you look at their labels, you've got like a muffin top. You got yourself a tramp stamp.
This isn't a joke shop or comic book store. It's Charles Street Liquors, the first stop on the chocolate and beer tour of Boston, the current crown jewel of Massachusetts startup tour company, Hip Host.
My name is Bill. It's Bill. I love hearing my name. So if any time you have any questions, comments, want to know things about the neighborhood, or anything we've tried, please feel free to say my name. He said I love hearing it. And I love to talk.
Bill Hall takes groups on a daytime tavern crawl throughout the city, studded with stops at local chocolate shops and his insane wealth of knowledge on all things beer in Boston.
All my time, while everyone else was doing college, I was doing everything else. I worked in cafes, restaurants, clubs. I was a cocktail waiter before. You name it, I've done it. And I finally found a job where I can take all my crazy random experience and put it all into one thing.
And Hall isn't just the guide of the Chocolate and Beer Tour of Boston. He's also the creator, coordinator, and developer. A one-man show. Through Hip Host, locals like him have the opportunity to pitch and create tours of their home turfs based on whatever their specific expertise is. For Hall, it's obviously beer and chocolate. But the company also boasts a Boston Civil War tour, record store tour, a handful of gallery and museum tours, and many more.
Travel is all about going and experiencing new places. And to truly experience, to have authentic experiences in new places, is not as simple as you think if you don't know anybody there.
Hip Host founder and CEO Mario Ricciardelli had had enough of cliche tourist traps while traveling, so he took matters into his own hands, along with his business skills and travel savvy, to change the way we do tourism.
What struck me is that, gee, why isn't there an opportunity to create a way to connect people, to have locals who know, have local expertise, they know all the cool places to go, the non-touristy locations, to have them create whatever kind of tour that they're interested in, whatever their expertise is, both, you know, taking into account their local knowledge as well as whatever they're passionate about, and package that up into a pretty inexpensive, reasonable tour where they can show people around. So it's kind of like having a friend.
While Hip Host offers tours in more than 66 locations around the world, it's not just tourists taking advantage of locals' offbeat knowledge of their cities. Ricciardelli says that the turnout is actually about half and half between visitors and natives. On my tour, there's a daughter celebrating her birthday with her out-of-towner mom, a couple on a first date, and a group of three Massachusetts teachers out on the town.
We just got Stella, because she's not a big beer connoisseur, so...
I recognize it.
The reason we're so popular with locals is because I'm not quacking at you. You're not doing the Freedom Trail. You're not seeing something that you've seen 100 times before. Whether you've lived here for 3 months or 30 years, you're going to learn something new on my tour.
Hip Host operates solely online, with prices ranging from $8 to $48 per person. Individuals and groups book their tours directly with the tour guides to coordinate timing and personalize their experience. According to founder Ricciardelli, a completely unique model.
No one's sort of doing exactly what we're doing. At least we haven't come across anyone.
Because of its popularity, the Chocolate and Beer Tour of Boston is the first of Hip Host tours to be offered at set times each week, not unlike some of the more conventional tours offered throughout Boston.
There's this choice between, you know, going on the big group tours, which we're not really into, akin to, you know, thinking about a tour guide either holding an umbrella with 20 people following them with cameras around their neck, or getting on a bus and people pointing things out, which we're absolutely not into, or hiring a private tour guide, which is brutally expensive.
What HipHost has come up with is sort of a combination of both, but more personal and less pricey. Matthew Reed Baker, the arts and culture editor of Boston Magazine, says that while traveling off the beaten track can seem appealing, larger tourist attractions shouldn't fall off the radar completely, like the historical Freedom Trail, or yes, even the duck tours.
Basically, when it comes to doing touristy things in Boston, I'm no snob. I think the city has amazing things and venues to do for yourself living here or for anybody coming to visit.
This tour is more than just beer and chocolate. It is the passion of a tour guide telling you about beer and chocolate and then everything else.
At only about 10 months old, HipHost is expanding worldwide with tours from Kenya to Colorado, but always staying close to home, showing off Boston's best places and spaces in a new way.
Student Nisa Lossing filed that report. This is WBUR. I'm Steve Brown with a special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. The next two stories look at innovations in the music industry. Our second story from Emily DeHardy tells us about a way to find new music. But first, here's student reporter Tara Jayakar with a story about a man who started his own record label.
5 years ago, at the age of 21, Al Polk moved to Boston from central Massachusetts to start Polk Records. He says he was inspired by Calvin Johnson of K Records and the movie Festival Express, and then just learned as he went.
What I'm doing is I'm making art. I'm helping others make art. I'm supporting others who make art, and I'm just farting around.
Polk Records now has 22 bands on the label. As it grew from just Al's band at first, Polk fostered friendships with other musicians, figuring out what help they needed.
A label doesn't have to be all, doesn't have to be everything for a band. It's not going to, like, baby a band necessarily. When here comes the airplane band, here you go. Here you go, be a good band now, go make some money, go make some songs, good band. You know, it's not that, it's about relationships. It's like believing in each other and supporting each other.
Polk says he started his label primarily to help his friends and bands who weren't organized enough to get their music to audiences. Even in a digital world, music marketing still requires a human connection.
I just want to help the band in whatever way I can. And Polk Records, it's not only about the final product, it's about the band and everyone showing initiative.
But in an age of rapid music sharing and home recording, the very concept of a label is changing. Perry Eaton is the founder of the music blog Alston Pudding.
I mean, a bigger label is, I feel like they have too much creative control over their own artists. It's more to market the name, market the band, market their whole brand behind their band, and make them their own money.
But Eaton says indie labels are different.
Small labels, I feel like, are more akin to a certain genre, a certain type of performer, a certain type of band, and will work closely to try and kind of foster that sound and help you kind of channel your own creativity and give you, as the artist, a little more creative control.
But how do labels that are more concerned with the creative process than the bottom line survive financially? For Polk, claiming a piece of the product is not what he's about.
I'm not making money off of it. I'm not trying to. That's their thing, you know? It's kind of the idea that whatever a band needs or whatever agreement we can come across, then that's how we work.
Polk gets by performing his own music and selling merchandise at concerts.
To be an indie label is like a weird thing because it's like, how are you going to survive? Everything boils down to time and money, I think. Funds just generate from the events themselves. I used to work like a 9-to-5, so I saved up some money and I just went on an adventure.
Major labels try to cover all the bases, promotion, recording, distribution, and then try to turn a profit from the band they've signed. Polk tries to figure out what each band needs and moves from there.
For Radio Control, I talked to them. I said, well, what do you want me to do? I was like, okay, well, I can be there to like listen to your recordings or whatever, give you feedback on that. Also, when the album is done, you know, we can promote it. Like, I know a lot of the radio stations, the DJs, and blogs, and newspapers. So a lot of this stuff is, like, just networking and knowing who the people are that you need to talk to.
The song Robot Machine is on the first album released by Radio Control last year, after several years working with Polk. Lead singer Matt Studevin says Polk was key in getting the band important gigs.
I think some of the success of our band is just the fact that he like talks about us all the time, and he doesn't have to do that. He does that because I genuinely feel that he likes us and he believes in what we're doing, just like we believe in what he's doing.
Another way Polk deviates from the old model is by representing and promoting visual artists. He helps arrange gallery shows or ask them to do album artwork for bands on Polk Records. Street artist Ian Sanity remembers meeting Polk for the first time.
It's like magical to meet Albert Polk, you know? Like, you just look at him and his beard is pirate-esque, and he's just like so smiley and happy and neon. I couldn't look away, but I couldn't like look directly at him. He was just so bright, and I was like, you're Albert Polk.
Sanity expected Polk would be some straight-laced business exec, but found him to be the exact opposite. Sanity says what Polk Records is doing isn't anything new, but it's crucial to the indie music scene.
Albert Polk is keeping the DIY movement alive, and that's a very honorable thing to do. Because it's, you know, it's easy to pay somebody to help you out, but it's not necessarily easy to have a much brain power and energy to do it all yourself.
Polk says he wants to continue Polk Records for as long as he can. He hopes it continues to grow with or without him. 5 years in, Polk says the label is more than he had ever hoped it would be, part of every person in it, but also bigger than all of them.
The Echo Nest was founded 7 years ago by two computer programmers who had just graduated from MIT. Brian Whitman and Tristan Jahan love music, and were always looking to find new bands. They set up a network of computers to identify new music and then analyze songs and performers. The information is cataloged to help their fellow music fans discover new music. Co-founder Tristan Jahan is the Echo Nest Chief Technical Officer.
There's a lot of machines that are crawling the internet and reading about music, so blog posts, reviews, news about artists, as well as programs that listen to the content. And so every MP3 we find through our partners or on the internet, we're going to analyze those and extract all kinds of musical information.
For example, if you're an indie rock fan and input had to be there by Ace Enders, I hear the drips and drones are a nightmare. You'll end up with a playlist that also includes Wooden Soldiers by the band Person L. When wooden soldiers catch their breath. It's similar to the Music Genome Project that automatically creates playlists for the popular online music site Pandora. But the Echo Nest sells its music information to the growing number of music services that compete with Pandora, most notably Spotify Radio. Spotify Radio allows subscription customers to download music. It also lets anyone discover music similar to their existing taste for free using the Echo Nest database.
We provide the data that allow Spotify to, for example, build a radio that is like Pandora within their own service. And they have 15 million songs, so you know, if you were comparing to Pandora, it's maybe about 15 times bigger.
Pandora has about 250 employees. Right now, the Echo Nest has 25. To flourish, its owners have to make deals with as many different music providers as they can. Jahan says, fortunately, new music apps are being developed all the time.
We have partnered with the EMI for different artists. You can build an application around that content, and they will publish the application and share the revenue with you.
Success also depends on continuing to grow its music database. That's also beneficial to musicians, like Ace Enders, who are just starting out and trying to build a following. Don Gorder chairs the music department at Berklee College of Music.
It's a huge, cluttered world out there for music. Bands that are trying to connect with an audience and build a fan base are finding that, yes, they can do that, but they're competing. A platform like Echo Nest that helps people to expand their base of musical appreciation. It gives them an opportunity to connect with people who may never have found out about them.
The explosion in music apps provides plenty of customers for the Echo Nest right now, but it also highlights the music industry's major concern. The industry is just beginning to adjust to the digital music revolution. The creators of Echo Nest know full well their product was something no one could imagine a dozen years ago, and how hard it is to figure out how music will be distributed a dozen years from now. Just like music.
Student reporter Emily DeHardy. Now here's student reporter Jackson Tobin, who tells us about an after-school program in Roxbury that's helping kids learn.
Thousands of kids in the Boston area have spent time with A26 in the last 5 years, writing, exploring, and learning. Studies that the center has compiled suggest about 90% of the elementary, middle, and high school students who have attended the free after-school program have seen their grades improve. Those students read and complete their homework. They write and publish stories at the in-house printing press. And sometimes, they even interview a giant squid.
Hi, my name's Nikila, and today I'm going to interview the giant squid on the telephone. Where do you live?
I was born off the coast of New Zealand. Now I travel a lot in the Tropic of Cancer.
How big are you?
I am about 100 feet long.
How long are your tentacles?
My tentacles each are about 200 feet long. They're longer than my body.
That's WA26 Monster Radio, a mock radio show that the students at the center wrote and assembled with a little help from the tutors. Just one of the ways that A26 Boston tries to boost the imaginations of its students. A26 Boston is a chapter of A26 National, a group of 8 educational centers around the country. Writer Dave Eggers founded the first one, A26 Valencia, in San Francisco 10 years ago. Eggers had heard complaints from many friends and colleagues who were teachers that students needed more one-on-one attention. Providing that attention is the goal of A26 Boston.
There's a lot being said about these kids, and a lot of times you're not hearing a lot said by these kids, and they're really the ones who know what's working for them and what the challenges are for them in their situations.
Karen Sama is the program director at A26 Boston.
What I like about the innovation here is that I think that sometimes the kids are not really aware of the innovation here. They just assume that everybody gets help behind a Bigfoot Research Institute, and the fact that they can take it for granted in a way when they can't take many things for granted in the world is pretty amazing. But also, I think it just sets a tone of wonder where we say, you know what, as adults, we're perfectly happy to let our imaginations wander and let it be okay and not care what other people say about it and take it to like its most fun extreme. This is a space when you can do that too, when the social pressure is for kids to not be different, you know, are so, so high.
But what do the kids think of the center?
How long have you been coming to A26?
3 years.
And what do you think?
It's okay.
So
Let me hear.
Can you tell me what you like best about A26?
I don't know.
Come on.
Everything. The tutors and stuff like that.
Everything. The tutors and stuff like that.
How long have you been coming to A26, John?
2 years.
2 years?
1 year.
1 year? And do you like it?
Yes.
What do you like about it?
Nothing really.
I thought you just said you like it.
Nothing really. I don't like A26, but it's fun here.
You don't like it, but it's fun?
Yes.
Do you like the people here?
Sort of.
And the other kids?
Yeah.
Yeah, you do?
A26 Boston offers after-school tutoring as well as in-school writing workshops. But the reach of the center is limited. Since it only serves as a complement to the schools in the city, the organization's success is tied to what the Boston Public Schools achieve. While all of A26 Boston's programs are free, the students are still a self-selecting group. Either their parents or the students themselves keep them coming back. Still, Dean Hardin Coleman of the Boston University School of Education insists that after-school programs like this are essential to close the achievement gap between children from low-income backgrounds and children from middle and upper-class families.
My kids, you know, they get up, I get them, I get to school, they come home at 3 o'clock, one of us would be there, or we'd have some in the house, they would start working their homework, then we would take them to music or to sports, and then we'd sit them to complete their homework at night. If I was a working-class parent working two jobs in this economy, I don't have the time and energy and resources to provide that for my children. So we as a community need to step in and provide the type of literacy training and social training and opportunities that middle-class families pay for. We need to provide that support for our poor kids, and that's fundamental to their success in school.
The achievement gap may be slowly closing. Boston Public Schools say since 2006, graduation rates among low-income students have risen almost 5 percentage points. But there is still work to be done. That only amounts to 63% of low-income students.
Today's show was produced by Steven, Nikila,
Ryan,
Philippe.
In association with A26 Boston.
Thanks for listening.
Student reporter Jackson Tobin. Here's Laura Hansen with a story on the global counterfeit pharmaceutical market and new ways being developed to protect patients.
When you pop an aspirin for a backache or pick up a prescription from the pharmacy, you probably don't question whether it's really the medicine that's listed on the label. But in many developing countries, sick consumers can be left guessing. Warren Kaplan works in pharmaceutical policy at the Boston University Center for Global Health and Development. He says that in many countries, finding quality medicines can be a challenge.
It's not obvious in many places that the pharmacist has any training. And people go to drug sellers who aren't even pharmacists. You can walk around the street and find people selling medicines. They may be expired. Who knows what people are getting? The regulatory system is sufficiently weak in some of these countries that people aren't licensed and they set up their shops and they sell meds, some of which maybe contain nothing.
The most commonly identified counterfeit drugs in this country are more expensive drugs, like for chronic diseases, or lifestyle drugs, like weight loss pills or Viagra. But in developing countries, inexpensive generics, like antimalarials, antibiotics, TB drugs, even antiretrovirals, are common targets for counterfeiters. Other times, Kaplan says, some drugs are just watered down, and even the drug sellers don't know they have substandard products.
You could definitely put water into a bottle that should be some drug, and if you do that intentionally, that's counterfeit. If the bottle says 100 milligrams and there's 50 in there, that's a substandard. That may or may not be intentional. Substandard medicines, in fact, may be a bigger problem than counterfeit medicines.
At best, substandard drugs have no effect. And at worst, they breed drug resistance or have a toxic effect on the patient. The disturbing rise in counterfeit and substandard drugs in the global market has largely been neglected. Estimates suggest that counterfeit drugs now make up 10% of the global pharmaceutical market and rake in billions of dollars each year. This translates into huge losses for pharmaceutical companies.
Drug sales for counterfeit medicines are up to $70 to $100 billion in 2010. That's a huge amount of money that's flying around in the stream of commerce.
Pharmaceutical companies are scrambling to find ways to recoup some of these losses and to ensure that patients get the safe and effective medicines that they need. Until recently, there hasn't been an easy way to identify counterfeit drugs. But a Cambridge-based venture capital company is working to give quality assurance back to patients. Alden Zecca is the CFO and strategist for that company, Sproxel.
The Sproxel solution helps consumers, primarily in the developing world, ensure that when they're purchasing a product, it is a genuine product that actually is coming from the manufacturer that it claims to be coming from. And so it enables those consumers to protect themselves from buying counterfeit goods.
Here's how the system works. After buying a Sproxel-protected product, the consumer scratches off a special label on the packaging. It's similar to an instant win lottery ticket. It reveals a randomly generated serial number unique to that individual product. The consumer then sends a text message to Sproxel with the code and receives an immediate response verifying whether the product is authentic.
Counterfeit products are now being driven out of the market and they're able to sell real product into the desired hands of the patients, or the hands that really want to buy that product from them.
The system seems to be working. Take Nigeria, a country that's notorious for its counterfeit drug problem. Sproxel says one out of every 200 people there has used its system to check a drug. And Zeka says Sproxel clients are beginning to recoup money lost to counterfeiters.
We have data that shows across several manufacturers, across several different therapeutic classes of drugs, that within 3 months, product sales have gone up by over 10% on a month-over-month basis.
But Zeka is the first to admit that Sproxel is not the silver bullet in solving this issue. Counterfeit and substandard drugs are so pervasive in the global market, continual innovation is needed to stay ahead of counterfeiters. There's another attempt to address the drug quality issue right here at Boston University. PhD engineering student Dirash Tassan is working on a product that would allow a pharmacist or drug supplier to easily test the quality of any drug. After inserting a sample into a handheld device, the pill is dissolved and analyzed. The user receives a description of what ingredients and how much are inside. The results can then be compared with the industry standard for that particular drug.
So at this point, you know, we're really just trying to push the development of the technology and to make sure that it's something that's, you know, robust and low cost and portable and easy to use. You know, if we can succeed in doing that, then where we apply our technology is kind of secondary.
Dirash says that ultimately he hopes the system will not only ensure the patients get the medicines they need, but also will help to identify how counterfeit and substandard drugs get into the market in the first place.
Hopefully it's something that we can scale to all of these levels and really kind of identify where in the supply chain things are breaking down. That's something that people don't really know.
Both Dirash and executives at Sproxel say the solution to counterfeit medicines lies in adaptable, easy-to-use technologies that put information and quality drug detection into the hands of manufacturers, regulators, and consumers. In the meantime, millions of sick consumers in the developing world must continue to take their chances.
Student reporter Laura Hansen. This is WBUR. I'm Steve Brown. In our final story tonight, student reporter Joel Senek tells us about an effort to revolutionize physical fitness.
Newton Center is filled with stores and restaurants, a perfect destination for 59-year-old artist and childcare worker Linda Goldberg.
Because of the gasoline prices, walking has increased, and now I'll try and do my local errands on foot or by bike.
After being diagnosed with osteoporosis, a bone-thinning disease, last November, Goldberg hopes to keep walking to Newton Center with the help of Mo Lanier, a fellow 59-year-old who runs the Greatest Age Fitness Center for those in the second half of their lives.
Okay, you're going to lower your right foot towards the floor, all in a vertical fashion. No forward motion off of it, and up you come. That's nice.
That's Mo Lanier, working with one of her many clients. The center has about 100 members from ages 48 to 91. Many have a history of staying active, but for some, the decision to get over their fear and into the gym can take some time.
For those folks who are uncomfortable, unsure of themselves, need a place to start that's not intimidating and full of athletes, they need a place, and then this is the place. It's a gentle entry.
This approach is exactly what Arizona State professor Matthew Booman says works well to help break down physical and psychological barriers that may exist when older adults face exercising at their age. Booman is an expert in physical activity for middle to older aged adults.
Start small, and start very small, especially with older adults, pointing out to them that in order to receive a health benefit, they don't need to be exercising at the intensity and the duration that they were exercising at when they were 30. They can receive health benefits with much smaller amounts.
Lanier's gym isn't conventional. The largest dumbbell is only 40 pounds. There are no machines in the room, and half of the floor is carpeted by a strip of field turf, where her members press and roll various parts of their body against cylinder-shaped pieces of hard foam. Some exercises include weight resistance, but others are more practical, like getting up from the floor, which isn't one of the more popular drills.
All the moaning and groaning that goes on when I say, okay, time to get down on the floor. And then they'll say, once they're down there, okay, time to get up. All right, time to get down. All right, time to get up. But they all know they're going to be up and down 15 times before they're done.
It's one thing that separates Lanier's club from a conventional gym. She has her clients steer away from machines and complete a regimen that includes daily situational exercises.
We do functional work that you would do in everyday activities, like how do you lift a laundry basket or how do you carry a bag of groceries.
And it helps that the demands are coming from someone who knows what it's like to be in their shoes. Andy Strauss is a 68-year-old member of the center.
There is some advantage for Mo not being 20 years old. Leaving it probably at that is that we all go through things physically as we get older, and Mo has gone through her share of ups and downs physically, and you work through those and you get a sensitivity, I think, for people who are a little older if you've had some of those experiences yourself.
A large wooden door slams shut every time Dee Towns enters her unit in a Victorian house in Newton Corner. Towns, who is 65, broke her ankle and hip bones after taking up figure skating in her 30s and 40s.
After injuring myself, it was like, well, knowing what exercises to do because I didn't want to re-injure myself. And so that's when I sought out, Mo and her help.
Dr. Carmen Seppa of Northeastern University is an expert on older adult exercise.
The issue that used to happen some years ago was that if an older adult is old and frail and sick, that person should not exercise. And what we have found from the science is that, in fact, that is the person that should exercise, that would benefit the most due to the muscle plasticity, meaning the ability of the muscle to respond to exercise and the beneficial effects that exercise has. That's exactly the best prescription, if you will.
One way that Lanier helps fill this prescription is by allowing her center to become more than just a place to build strength, but also personal relationships. Mary Bell is 60 years old and has been coming to the gym since it opened over a year ago.
She really worked hard on making sure everyone knew everyone's names, and that's helped a lot. We've had a party. We're about to have our anniversary party, and we do. We have fun.
If we can have fun together, then we can be together. And if we laugh about the silly things like getting on the floor and getting up, or we laugh about joint pain, or we laugh about I didn't sleep well last night, or laugh about all the things that happen, and in particular, some of them are around the aging process, but just have a good time, and it just lightens the whole thing up.
The Greatest Age Fitness Center is only a year old, but Lanier says that she hopes her center will encourage more older adults to get or stay active, even as the years roll by.
Student reporter Joel Sapp. That concludes tonight's special edition of Boston University's World of Ideas, featuring stories written and produced by students from this semester's Advanced Radio Journalism class in the College of Communication. Our student contributors were, in order of appearance, Angus Dunk, who graduated today with a degree in broadcast journalism and hopes to become a firefighter; Annie Ropey, who graduated today with a degree in classics and philosophy. She's pursuing a career in public radio. Tim McCann, who graduated today with a degree in both political science and broadcast journalism. He hopes to remain in Boston working for a nonprofit group or advocacy organization. Nisa Lossing, who graduated today with a degree in journalism. Tara Jayakar, who graduated today with a degree in English and hopes to support herself by writing about music. Emily DeHorty, a broadcast journalism student who expects to graduate in December. Jackson Tobin, who graduated today with a degree in journalism. Laura Hansen, who's studying internal health management at the School of Public Health and spending the summer working on a mobile health project in Namibia. Joel Senek, who is completing a master's degree in journalism and will finish his coursework in the nation's capital as part of BU's Washington Journalism Program. Thanks to Boston University Associate Professor Ann Donahue, who helped edit their stories. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mark Degon, with help from Mike Toda, Michael Garth, and Missy Webb. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lidotes. I'm Steve Brown. Congratulations to all of today's graduates, and thanks for joining us.